This is Vatican Radio. Pope Francis is celebrating the 47th anniversary of his priestly ordination on Tuesday, the 13th of December 2016. He will soon mark another milestone when he turns 80 years old on Saturday, the 17th of December. As this significant year comes to an end, we take a look back at some of the Pope's highlights over the past 12 months, which include 6 overseas visits and the extraordinary Jubilee Year of Mercy. Susie Hodges spoke to John Allen, editor of Crux and author of 9 books on Vatican and church affairs. He was first asked about what the lasting impact of the Year of Mercy might be.
Well, let's begin with Pope Francis himself. I mean, of course, we don't know how much longer this papacy will go on, but however long it is, I suspect looking back, Pope Francis will tell you this was its peak moment. This was its most important year. Because, of course, it was the special Jubilee Holy Year of Mercy, and mercy is the spiritual lodestar, the kind of Rosetta Stone for this papacy that is the foundation for everything else. I think Francis would probably tell you that providentially he believes he was elected to sort of revivify the Church's witness to mercy. And that was very much the aim of this year. Now, in terms of what its lasting impact is going to be, that is hard to say. Of course, Pope Francis has asked every diocese in the world to create some kind of ongoing work of mercy, whether a hospital or a clinic or a school or a soup kitchen, something that will project this message and this work of mercy into the future. Beyond that, I will say this, as I move around the Catholic world, I do think that people have gotten the memo, that is, that the Holy Father is calling them not merely to feel more merciful towards others, but to spend some of their time in concrete works of mercy. It may be hard to measure that empirically, but I do think that over time, there is a kind of transformative effect that this year may have, analogous, I suppose, to the Great Jubilee of 2000 called under John Paul II, which called the Church to evangelization. This Jubilee has called the Church to mercy, and I think in both cases, over time, we will be able to see its fruits.
I think some of the most powerful aspects were the Pope's own concrete gestures of mercy, which he did one Friday a month. He reached out to people you wouldn't perhaps expect him to reach out to, like men who had left the priesthood.
Yes, that's right. He reached out to men who have left the priesthood. He reached out to prisoners. He reached out to the homeless, virtually every marginalized population you can imagine. And let us be clear, although those moments were personally important to Francis, they were opportunities for him to be engaged in direct pastoral outreach, which is very much his life's blood. You know, he's also a very savvy political operator, and he understands that they were, to some extent, photo ops intended to set a tone for what leadership in the Catholic Church is supposed to look like. And in that sense, I think they were also about recalibrating how we understand power in the Church, understanding it as an opportunity for service rather than as an opportunity to lord it over others, which is, of course, very much one of the thrusts that this Pope has been trying to get across.
Let's move on next to his pastoral visits overseas. He went to Cuba, Mexico, Lesbos, Armenia, Krakow in Poland, Azerbaijan, Georgia, and Sweden. All very different journeys in a way, but do you see there his concern with the countries on the periphery? Do you see a certain common themes running through those visits, and which of them for you were some of the most striking?
Well, in some ways, I thought the most striking visit, and let's be clear, there were 6 overseas visits by Pope Francis in 2016, which is an unusually high number, particularly for a Jubilee year. I thought perhaps the most striking one of all was the shortest. It was his day trip to the Greek island of Lesbos on the 16th of April. Lesbos, of course, being one of the primary points of arrival for migrants and refugees washing into Europe, part of the continent's greatest refugee crisis. Second World War. And clearly, Pope Francis wanted to go to Lesbos to make a statement about the human dignity, the human rights of migrants and refugees. Obviously, that trip ended with him bringing a group of Syrian refugees back with him aboard the papal plane to Rome. The other striking element about that visit was that he did it in the company of Patriarch Bartholomew of Constantinople and also the Orthodox Archbishop of Athens in Greece. So there was a clear ecumenical thrust there. And I think in miniature, that captured the spirit of the Pope's, all six of the Pope's visits. They were about going to the peripheries, and there was also a clear ecumenical thrust to these visits throughout the years, particularly those trips to the Caucasus, Georgia, Azerbaijan, and also the last trip of the year to Sweden to mark the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. So I think the peripheries, ecumenism, those were the hallmarks of the Pope's travels, and I think he would argue they are both logical extensions of the spirit of the Jubilee of Mercy.
Let's look next at papal documents. His apostolic exhortation that was issued after the Synod on the Family, Amoris Laetitia, this was a document that created some waves, let's say. Do you see it as a very groundbreaking document?
Amoris Laetitia certainly is a groundbreaking document. I mean, for one thing, it is a magnificently pastoral treatment on family life, which, if taken seriously in the trenches, church around the world, could reconfigure the way the church understands its outreach to families, to married couples, marriage preparation, and so on. It is also groundbreaking in the sense that it is one of the most controversial papal documents in recent memory, because, of course, there is that one point in the document that was deeply divisive during the two synods of bishops in 2014 and 2015 and remains contentious today, and that is the question of whether divorced and civilly remarried Catholics can have access to the sacraments. I think the face value reading of Amoris Laetitia and its famous footnote 351 is that the Pope cautiously opened a door to that, but of course he did not change church teaching or church law, which has allowed different bishops in different parts of the world to interpret this document differently. Clearly, Pope Francis does not wish yet to definitively resolve that debate. Instead, I think it is clear he wants to see how this plays out on the ground for a while before he issues a binding and definitive magisterial response. And it has injected a bit of a mess into Catholic life, frankly, but then this is a Pope who has repeatedly called on Catholics to make a mess, to break the mold, to take chances in order to make the gospel relevant to people in the concrete circumstances of lives. I think the short-term forecast is that we are going to be living with that mess for a little while.
2016 also saw the ongoing reform of the Roman Curia, which Pope Francis put into action shortly after his election, and it saw also the creation of two new dicasteries. Again, what's your take on this?
Well, I think the work of the Roman Curia, and I think Pope Francis and his council of nine cardinal advisors from around the world would be the first people to tell you this, remains a work in progress. We have seen the creation of two new sort of super Vatican departments, one for basically the peace and justice issues, the other for family, laity, and life issues. But of course, those are brand new outfits, and we don't yet know how they are going to work in practice. They are designed to achieve economies of scale, consolidate a number of previous congregations and councils and so on, and academies. They are also designed to raise the profile of those two issues, those two clusters of issues. But whether that's actually how it works in practice, remains to be seen. We have also seen ongoing work towards the implementation of the Pope's much-desired financial reform of the Holy See. There were some hiccups along the way, debates during 2016 over who exactly was going to call the shots on the administration of the Vatican's financial resources. Everyone insists that the spirit of the financial reform is to inject greater levels of transparency and accountability. So, I think the verdict here, Susie, has to be on 2016 is that the ball got moved in significant ways on reform of the Roman Curia, but it is not yet across the goal line.
December of 2016 sees two important anniversaries in Pope Francis's own life. The first, the anniversary of his ordination to the priesthood, and the second, his 80th birthday. And as we've all seen, he's an incredibly active person. He could be described as a workaholic, and he doesn't look like many 80-year-olds that you see around the place, does he?
No, I mean, Pope Francis could be the poster boy for the motto that 80 is the new 60. At 80 years old, he remains more active, more committed, more frenetic, almost at times, than most 60-year-olds. I mean, for that matter, than people significantly younger than that. So, I think of these two milestones, that is, his 80th birthday and then the anniversary of his ordination to the priesthood, in terms of Francis's own psychology and his own spirituality, I suspect he would tell you that the one that means far more to him and that has far more immediate significance to him is the anniversary of his ordination. Because I think one of the striking things about watching Pope Francis in action is that although he is, of course, conscious that he is the vicar of Christ, he is the successor of Peter, he is the governor of the universal church, in his heart of hearts, and in terms of those moments during the day that give him greatest pleasure, they tend to be those moments when he can, for a kind of brief shining moment, act simply as a parish priest. I think in many ways he sees himself as the world's parish priest. It's those moments of direct pastoral contact with ordinary people, whether it's writing a letter to a 9-year-old Italian girl who's dying of a disease, or whether it's standing in the middle of a prison and offering consolation and hope. Those sorts of moments, when he gets to reconnect with those priestly roots that I think typically bring him most alive. And I think it is probably that continues to drive him forward right now, rather than the consciousness of his increasing age, because frankly, if you watch him in action, there don't seem to be too many visible signs of that increasing age.
No, he certainly seems to be very healthy.
Yes, you know, at the beginning of 2016, I had predicted that we might see some kind of papal health scare during this year, precisely because I was conscious that he was nearing 80 years of age, and given the schedule that he keeps up, of course, famously refusing to take the traditional summer break at the papal residence in Castel Gandolfo outside Rome, spending Friday afternoons and often Sunday afternoons in these kind of surprise impromptu moments of direct pastoral contact with people, and then during the week, keeping up a breakneck pace. I had thought at some point this would simply be unsustainable, but, you know, we did not see any significant papal health scare during 2016, nor are there any signs right now that he's slowing down. And when you see him up close and personal, you would not know you're looking at an 80-year-old man. You would think you're looking at somebody who is in the prime of health and who is full steam ahead.
I was speaking there to John Allen, editor of Crux and a leading commentator on papal and church affairs.